Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Carl Carlson.
Hey, Carl. You done anything useful lately?
Yeah, I was solving the problem of flickering lights in our kitchen. Ooh. And I had an old dimmer switch that was not LED friendly. And I put in these new LED lights.
Yeah.
And they start flickering. I'm going, what's going on here? These are LED lights that were, quote, dimmable. And had to then we have the old non-dimmable.
Just a potentiometer in the...
Yeah, it was just like a potentiometer. It was not friendly with LED. It was a dimmable switch, but not friendly with LEDs. And so I had to learn about the compatibility and this type of thing. And then, of course, went online and bought the materials, and they arrived the next day, and problem solved.
Yeah.
So that was valuable.
Yeah, when I start seeing flickering lights, I'm thinking if something's arcing someplace. That's usually not a good thing.
It's not a good thing to have flickers.
No, it's one of those things that, so did you get appropriate appreciation for solving the problem? And
I did. Good feedback from my life partner.
Yeah.
And everything is good. But what's nice about that is going start to finish, following that thread of what adds value to our household. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to look at the price, had to look at the quality of life, had to look at how it's improved in the house, you know, things like that.
Well, this idea of fixing a light bulb that's not flickering is pretty immediate, right? Now we've got steady light and we can go. And that's what's expected. That's what we had before. Something changed. It's not working. Then we restored it. It's not always that quick to get feedback. It's not always that easy to say, yeah, that was useful or not useful. And I know you've run into it setting up an FMEA study, right? And I've had directors tell me, well, what are you going to do with, you know, five of my engineering team for a day? That seems like a lot of time. And you're just going to create a report of how our product can fail. What am I going to do with that?
and you know, just as an aside on that particular topic, I value the time that people spend in FMEA meetings, which should be true in any meeting. Mm-hmm. I value that very highly. And so when I teach FMEA, I say, when you're running these meetings, you have to recognize the time of these people is very valuable. And so preparation has to be done well. We can't be talking about things that are off topic and, you know, waste time. Mm-hmm. And I have what I call the quality objectives for FMEA. There's 10 of them. Well, the 10th one is, was the time spent in the FMEA a value-added result? And when I audit the FMEAs against these quality objectives, I interview the team. And I say, was this useful to you? Did this add value to your job? Did you learn something from it? Because I want to know that the FMEA actually did something positive in their work. In addition to all the other things it's supposed to do, did it really add value to their work?
Right. And our listeners, I'm sure, have run into meetings where, well, this could have been done in a 2-minute email, right?
Yeah.
Or a voicemail or something like that. Right? We didn't need to get together for an hour to chat. And then we filled the hour. There's some law in that, isn't there? The time spent in a meeting will expand to fill the time allotted or something.
Yes.
Like that.
Yeah. If it's an hour meeting, you'll somehow find an hour's worth of stuff.
That's right. I had one manager that just loathed doing that. And he says, yeah, I've got five engineers sitting here, and if I keep you for an extra half hour, that's 2.5 hours of productive time that I've stolen from them. So when we were done with what we came to meet about and that objective was done, said, right, now go back and go do something useful. You get half hour free.
Yeah.
So we go stand by the coffee pot and talk about something.
But there's a value calculation that's if you're in management, and this is why it's important from a reliability engineering point of view, because there's this intersection with reliability management. And everything we do needs to add value to the product development process, to the product, to the manufacturing process. And we would do well as reliability engineers to be thinking about the value of each step that we're adding to this process.
Yeah. You know, the easiest way to think of it is, and we were talking about celebrating failures in our last discussion, mm-hmm. is we're off in the lab, we've got a prototype, we're working with a vendor or something, and we find this flaw or an error or a failure mechanism of some sort that we didn't know about before. One of the steps I do immediately is try to understand the failure mechanisms, because I want to know, is this going to happen to all production, or is it going to happen to a subset, or what's the scope or impact of this particular issue, right? With just how big of a problem is this? But by doing that step and then saying the one next to it after that is, this will cost us $18 million in the first year. Right?
Yeah.
If we don't fix this, we're going to have this failure rate, and each failure costs this much, and run the numbers out with your production quantity. And if I just say, hey, we found a failure, I get oftentimes like, so what? You only saw that on one sample. That's a one-off. It's no big deal. But the combination of the understanding of the failure mechanism, no, this is a wear pattern. There's not enough margin here. It's going to, given our use models, this will happen X amount of times, and there's the ramification of it. I found that if you don't add that quantification of the impact, the dollars essentially, it's too easy to go, oh, that'll never happen. But once they hear the impact, it becomes comparable to the bill of materials budget or the investment of the R&D team or the expected sales or profit, right? It's got to have some level that it's, the value of your finding has got to be comparable to what the organization is valuing.
Yeah, there's a language of that business communicates in a certain language, and part of that language is dollars or it's the whatever the currency is, and it's very important for reliability engineers to be able to communicate in that language. And I don't mean in a false way. In other words, I don't mean in a PR way,
right,
that I can save you tons of money type of thing.
Right.
I mean that we have time to failure probability distributions. We have a lot of information that in the right construct, in other words, putting together the right way, we can communicate in a language that management's actually very interested in. They want to know what the cost is going to be, not just during product development, but fixing failures, what the cost is going to be for spare parts and warranty support.
Right.
All of that, part of that calculation comes from reliability engineers.
Well, we see it too often is where we know about this issue. It's going to cause a 0.5% change in failure rate. Okay, so what? What does that mean? Right. Especially with somebody that's not dealing with the total failure rate or modeling it or doing anything else, is like,
yeah,
what does that mean?
Take it a little further.
That's right. Yeah.
There's a couple subjects that come to mind. One is, and I learned this years ago. Deborah Heasy was very helpful in teaching me this back in the 1980s, which is life cycle costing. And you can get in your silo, you know, of product development, whatever, and you have budgets that relate to your work, and your management has budgets. But who's got the budget of the overall product life cycle?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm talking from concept to the retirement of the product. That's the cost that we should be thinking about, which is the cost of not just the cost of development, but the cost of during first year, second year, all the way up through end of life.
Well, the customer has that onus,
yeah,
right? Because they ultimately are going to pay for it, whatever the total cost is. And that's where I think it breaks down is in a number of people have been talking about this, and the life cycle costing is the concept, right? To focus on that total number, even though you and your silo don't pay that. Mm-hmm. I had one director once, an engineering director said, why do we want to improve the product? If it delays me shipping the product, right, we failed. And I says, that's so short-term thinking.
Oh my God, you know,
because if it goes to operations and they can't build it, or it goes to customers and it hits the warranty line, then the organization loses, right? And it's a and he goes, but my budget is on this, and I've got this budget and this timeline. And if we save money on warranty, operations keeps that because they're the one that pays the warranty budget, not me. It doesn't come out of my budget.
And I was at a company last year. You want to see me bristle? this is the subject. We're talking about the reliability testing, and I go, why? What's the design life? And they said it was like 12 years or something. And then why are you testing it to a 3-year exposure? Well, that's what the warranty is. And my blood started to. What about the customer? What about after warranty? Well, we don't pay for that. Yes, you do. I mean, if you want business, I mean, it's a whole mindset of considering the total cost, as you point out, including the customer.
Yeah, it doesn't take an MBA to figure this out. Although, unfortunately, no. The MBAs tend to look at what's in my boundaries, what's in my organization, what are the inflows and outflows to XYZ company. And then it's almost like just lip service to the extended market and market share and how what we decide to do here affects those things. It's like, oh, if we make a better product, it's better for our customers. But when push comes to shove, I'm going to do what affects my bottom line in the short term piece.
And I remember some conversations at GM years back when we were looking at putting more investment into hybrids and mm-hmm. electric and things like that. And there was a certain sector of people that were going, well, where's the immediate payoff?
Right.
It's not there. And so they were arguing that we shouldn't pursue an activity unless you're getting a payoff pretty quickly. Well, why is that? Because that's their value model.
That's right.
Other people like myself were saying, let's invest time and energy for the longer term, and then it would pay off handsomely. And so part of the subject of value is your time frame. And because if you're in a time frame that's looking at value as crisis, like you get immediate payoff because you fix a problem, that type of thing, mm-hmm. that's part of the equation. You have to do that. But another part of it is looking for the long term, where you have to invest in value for a payoff that's down the road.
That's right. And, you know, it's the same with quality, though. The reliability folks is when the product works, right? When we launch a product and we're hitting our warranty targets and our customers like it over the long haul and we're doing all the things well, and there's air quotes here, no failures, then the manager looks at you going, so what good are you? What did you do? You know,
yes.
You did the FMEAs, you did the feedback to the design team, you made sure there's plenty of margin in it, you've exposed any weaknesses or flaws, we've designed it out, right? That takes a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
But if there's and you've seen it in some cultures where, in organizations where, if there's a field failure on, say, like the second unit shipped or the line is down because they found something on it, the design team jumps in and they're the hero. They solve it and everything mm-hmm. goes back to work. And they get a bonus and they get the parking
spot.
They
get the celebrations. They get the acknowledgments. I was having a conversation with some people at one of our gatherings over the Thanksgiving holiday about Stephen Covey's four quadrants. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about it in personalized, but it applies to your work as well. So if you could imagine, if you could imagine one axis is the, I'll call it the importance axis, and the other axis is the urgency. So you could have a high or low importance, and you can have a high or low urgency. And so one quadrant is it's urgent and it's important. That's a no-brainer. You've got to work on that.
Right.
But the one that's not as urgent, but it's very important, that quadrant tends to get pushed to the side. And Covey teaches you have to schedule your time and you have to consciously put yourself in that environment where you work on things that are not time urgent, but they're very important. And that was a great lesson.
Those become the deferred maintenance, right? Yes. Those in the factory setting is, yeah, it's really important we fix that, but it's not broken right now. So we'll wait. We'll keep going.
Until
the crisis. Now it's urgent. Now we got to fix it. And if we would have fixed it when it was merely important, it would have been half the cost. We would have had less downtime. The same applies in all kinds of realms. The ones that get a ton of attention are the urgent and not important because they're quick and easy to do, but they need them done today. You can check them off your list. We have this mindset to do what's in front of us today. And
it's so part of the culture today too, Fred. It aids in the distractibility of people because they wait for the notification to come in or they wait for the little urgent message and they start reacting to it. And it sort of takes over your life instead of planning your life to ignore the unimportant, urgent things.
Which takes discipline. It really does. Now, this whole idea of value and reliability stuff, we talk about the money stuff and looking at important stuff. And if you know the value of, say, test to failure, and your team is going to balk at the cost of that and so on. Well, it's that value calculation that helps. And it's not just the cost of failures. The failure rate costs and warranty costs are the easiest one, in my mind, to do. But there's also value in, like we were talking about last time, Carl, in celebrating failures. There's value in finding a failure so that you have the information to make a good decision. If you didn't know how it failed, how in the world are you going to decide whether this test was relevant or not, right?
Yeah.
And so there's all these different scenarios that saves you time, it saves you money, it saves you uncertainty. You reduce the variability of the knowledge you have around something. There's a common phrase, I'm sure it's in a movie someplace, is, well, what keeps you up at night? And it essentially is, what are you worried about? What's your gut telling you, your subconscious alerting you that something's not right? And if you can go to your program manager and say, what's keeping you up at night? And he says, well, we have this new technology and we don't really understand. I know it's going to fail, but I don't know how. I can do something with that, right? Mm-hmm. But I need $100,000 to go find it out. So how much value is a good night's sleep to you? right, and I've used that line and they go, it's worth $100,000. Let's go sort that out.
Okay.
Because they knew at some point they're going to have to make a decision. And if they have this cloud of uncertainty, it taints that decision. So they were able to then quantify the value of knowing, right? If we go off and do a bunch of work and we find he wasn't worried, he didn't have anything to worry about, that's good information. If we go to a bunch of work and we find that, oh, here's this lurking monster, we got to figure it out. Well, we start working on it sooner than later, right? And we learn something and it's valuable. So it's the value is not always just reduce the failure rate. That's my point. It can be all kinds of things. And I've run into this with Halt. Kirk and I talked about it is if time to market is your driving force, the warranty cost is just not an issue, right? We're not going to worry about that. We have this time to market drive. Well, and then how do you justify a Halt test in that environment? He goes, well, if I find the failure on the first couple prototypes that you would have found otherwise and delayed your program, I've saved you the risk of delaying your program. And then we can quantify the value of, well, how often does this occur? What's the Halt test make a change and how often that occurs? What's the probability of delaying a program, cost of the delays and so on? So the trick in value calculations, in my mind, is this: what's important to that decision maker, right? It could be time to market. It could be cost. It could be engineering productivity. Could be looking good. Whatever it is the calculations tend to have to be in that currency.
It does. And what you're doing, and I'm listening to this very interestedly, is you're bridging the gap between what the engineering results are and how you characterize those in language that management understands. Yep. And value is that translation. It is very much a value thread. And I would take it even a step further. I think it's a real career builder. I think if reliability engineers can make it a habit to think in terms of value on what they're doing personally, what you're doing with teams, what you're doing with projects, and communicate that way in a meaningful way, not PR, but actual meaning, that's a real boost to one's career.
Yeah, it definitely is. And, you know, Carl, we've written about this.
Yes, we have.
And, you know, we have, I think, close to 500 people that have signed up to take a review of the book that we're working on. And it reminds me, I think I need to get my act together. I've been swamped the last couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. And get a chapter done. But if you head into AscendoReliability.com, and underneath ebooks, under the drop-down menu for ebooks, is the Reliability Engineering Management is our working title. And you can log into that and get full access to all of our drafts so far and provide us feedback and what's working, what's not working. Plus, then you learn about what's coming up. But take a particular look at the value discussions in there.
Which is in chapter two.
Chapter two. Mm-hmm. And let us know what works for you, what doesn't work, what resonates, what's a good story from your experience of where this has worked or not worked, or what barriers you're seeing. Because we really, really want to make sure that chapter, which is so essential to doing reliability engineering, that it's very, very clear and helpful. So we really, really would appreciate your feedback on that.
Very good.
Yeah, cool. All right. Say, hey, Carl, let's go do something useful for the rest of the day.
All right. Sounds good to me, Fred.
All right. Talk to you later, Carl.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.